Accession number 17183, Roman halter, reel 13, followed after a pause by reel 14. Left channel is informant only, right channel informant and interviewer.
Roman halter, and this is reel 13, Roman. And I'd like to ask you, if I may, you know, to pick up on the education that you missed. You know, you were a young boy, weren't you, when the war started?
When the war started, I was 12.
Yes.
12 years old.
And I think you have explained that really you had no formal education until you came really to Britain and picked up training, as it were.
Yes. My education in Poland consisted of a school called Szkoła Powszechna, which is the, one calls it a public school. It was compulsory for everyone to attend it, but it means quite opposite from a public school. It's a school that everyone had to attend. And I was fortunate in that I had a teacher called Mrs. Wiśniewska, who advanced with us from year to year till the outbreak of war. And she was a wonderful person. She was not Jewish. She was a friend of my mother's. And she taught us right from Downing socks to about the size of the planet, various things, not only reading and writing. And her husband was rather rude because he, for some reason, he didn't like Jews, and he taught us math and marching. So he really is a sort of black spot in my mind. But whatever she taught me, really sunk in. And also in our house, apart from the prayer books and Yiddish books, there were also books about literature. My mother really had a lovely library. I remember at six, when I was, had an appendicitis. I looked for the books which had pictures inside. My reading then wasn't so very good. But that illness, which took a long time for me to recuperate after the operation, taught me quite a lot about Poland.
So when the war came, and you know all this was interrupted, you would have been literate, wouldn't you, by the sounds of it?
I could write and read. Yes, and I also knew a certain amount of multiplying addition. And lots about Polish kings, Polish geography, which was emphasized, because Poland became a nation really after the First World War again. And it was really compulsory to learn about Polish history. And we had to learn who was Mickiewicz, the poet, and Chopin, and various poems, very heroic poems, very nationalistic poems, which we had to learn by heart every 2 weeks, a little few lines. So in this respect, yes, because knowing how to read and write in ghetto when I was very starved, I could hardly express myself. I could not talk because talking required energy, and because I was so starved, I found it was easier for me to record and have a little notebook. And I wrote then rhyming poems. When I took my booklet to the three sisters who survived, the Pinchewski sisters, and showed them, they said, "Don't strain yourself to rhyme, just write." Because all this sort of shoo, moo, doesn't make sense really in the context of the conditions we are living. And I took that criticism at first badly, but when I thought about it, it was all right. Nothing of the writing survived, but it gave me a lovely opportunity of saying what I felt, because I was such an outsider. And that was a creative way for me to express myself fully. But I was totally raw when we came to England, and I really dearly hoped that I would be sent to a proper school and receive education. But for certain reasons, because I didn't get on with certain members of the committee, I was asked out, really, from the care of the committee. And I was apprenticed at Slough and lived in Windsor. And really, part of the education which I received is learning from the people around me. And they, after work, took me for English and math, giving half an hour, three quarters of an hour of their time after work. So I stayed behind in the drawing office, and one man took me for English, one man took me for math, one for geography, one for general knowledge.
How easy was that, you know, bearing in mind that you hadn't had any formal education for so many years?
Sorry, how?
How easy or difficult was it for you to learn again in a formal way?
Well, the first hurdle was really to learn English. And once I began to understand the humor of English, then I felt I was making good progress in English. And because I had such a thirst for knowledge, I really appreciated it. And they really, the feeling after the Second World War was that they took it up on themselves that we have to educate Roman a little, fill him in with a certain amount of knowledge. And the filling in was a food that I was thirsting for. So after my apprenticeship, after 3 years, I had my qualification to begin studying architecture.
Do you think, looking back, you know, at your experiences in the war, that was an education of a sort?
Well, that was a terrible education, really, because one had to learn the art of reading the brutality and the sadism on people's faces. There's also quite a lot of things which one had to uneducate oneself according to the teaching, religious teaching. We thought that goodness and charity and innocence are all rewarded. This wasn't so. One found that the brutality and the idea that no matter how you behaved, you were earmarked for murder, was a strange thing to conceive. And one felt terrible fear, because every situation was a new situation. So the situation of something terrible yesterday did not quite repeat itself tomorrow, but was a very strange experience to learn. And the accumulation of that made one totally aware of one's sort of, one was alive really to brutalities very much more than one would be otherwise. That one was in a state that one had to look around like a little bird, left, right and center, to find out who is behind you, who is in front of you, what is happening, how are people reacting, are we going to survive this hour or this day, this minute? And all this took place. The first shock, of course, was, which I related, when I saw my friends from my town, Jewish friends, being murdered. And then this sort of realization that the people who attended your school, Shkoa Povshechna, were the ones who were already in uniform after such a short time to do this murdering. I could not quite understand how this sort of conversion could come about, whether every human being is capable of being turned like that. And when I jumped out to something else, when, for instance, Mrs. Fuchs hid me, and I had to write a few words regarding that time. I said that was such an extraordinary sense of courage to hide me as a Jew, where the punishment was immediate death, and she also hid two others, three of us. I am saying now that if I had such an opportunity, I would do the same, but I know also that it's so much easier to say than do it. One can say it, but when it comes to the act, one realizes the punishment one's going to be meted out, that perhaps one would think twice about of doing it. This education of concentration camps, ghetto, slave labor, it's such a subnormal thing that really it does not relate to life the way we have it now. And therefore, it is an experience which is a sub-experience. And it is an experience which human beings must not be subjected to, because it is below level of normality and humanity. So to learn afresh here was something that once I knew to read, and I could find out from people what people read. Things became tremendously exciting for me, because although I studied, I've had so much studied architecture, I had so much energy to read. And then when I had children, I found out what books they should have. So really, the world became tremendous. It was a world of sunshine rather than darkness.
How easy was it, though, for you to trust people, bearing in mind, you know, the fear you had experienced and the need to keep your eyes and ears open all the time? How easy was it for you to sort of relax into British society?
You read society when you culturalize, and when you go to another country, you find the expressions, the intonations, the language. It's very strange to you. I went skiing to Norway, and I found I could not read the expressions and the responses of the Norwegians, because they don't laugh very much. They have very dour faces. It's only when one reads Tolkien, one must have could understand it very much more. So once I got to know the society here, I could read the responses of people towards me somehow very much better. And the experience of the past were not related to it. They were quite new experiences of reading people's expressions, their intonations, their attitudes. And my personal attitude was, trust the person. And really, there's a wonderful sort of expression which is translated from Chinese. Fool me once, blame on you. Fool me twice, blame on me. So if I was fooled twice, I knew that I must not trust this person. Once is enough. And really, even now, when somebody lets me down, I don't allow myself to be let down twice if I can help it. But I usually assume the best of people.
You were saying earlier, when you were talking about the boys, you know, the group that came to England, to the Lake District, that there was a general lack of bitterness for what had happened to you, you know, towards the Germans and others.
Yes, most of them wanted to get on with life. Most of them had that sediment of goodness which was instilled by their families when they were very young. And they were not conditioned in murder. In fact, all the time this was alien to people. And right immediately after the war, none of them really took revenge, as far as I know.
And was that, did you feel like that?
Yes, exactly that. what we felt, really, that those who committed atrocity, if they are found, they should be isolated from us. We weren't sitting on judgment. They should be hung, shot, murdered. But they should be isolated from society because we need protection and they need to be isolated from us. And such terrible crimes which were committed by them should be at least punished in a way that they should exist away from normality rather than benefit from the charity of human existence.
You were saying earlier, you know, when you were describing your childhood, the synagogue and the lovely religious life, really, that you and your family and the community led. Do you find that the anti-Semitism you suffered and the way the persecution as well, did it affect your sense of being Jewish?
No, really. One felt it's like a blackbird who can't say, I want to have white feather. We were Jewish. There were other wonderful birds that flew around. And we were Jewish, not simply that. And the best brains in a community in our town were the ones who were on the committee of Jewish committee. And the rabbi was always the man who led the community. In fact, when the community could afford a superb rabbi, a very wise one, very learned one, there was a celebration when he arrived. And he was the center of this community. And what one did is, against the anti-Semitism that existed, one literally put up the barriers, the walls, in order to protect oneself. But there was no question of revenge, because we recognize that we were a minority. And as a minority, one had to make intelligent moves in order to minimize this sort of anti-Semitism as far as one could. But we children felt the warmth of the community and the warmth of the family. And there was a certain continuity of structure in that way.
How about, you know, during the war when you were in the ghettos and the different camps? Did you manage to retain that pride in being Jewish? Because that's what you've explained, isn't it? This... You know, the fact that
no, first and foremost, the desire to survive came first. The Jewishness was relegated far down. There are certain myths going around among Orthodox people that they were exchanging bread on Passover for bits of corn, which they ground down and bake in order to make matzo. This is absolute nonsense. This is a lie. No person could do this. And in fact, the religious belief was so far as one held within one the race of God, but nothing, not prayers, not really, not rituals. And no celebrations of certain holidays. Every day was the same. And when I was talking to some people who were Orthodox, they said to me, tell me, if it came to renouncing Jewishness and becoming a Gentile or losing your life, you would rather lose your life, wouldn't you, in such circumstances? I said, oh no, I would choose life every time. And that was the feeling of the people who were around me. There were mostly exceptions. There were quite a lot of people who repeated prayers, but they didn't know their meaning, the Hebrew meaning. And to them, that was a sort of magical form, to such an extent that when we arrived in Auschwitz, people were repeating certain psalms when they found out where they were. And this sort of murmur, together with the sweat of fear, produced the hum and a stench of their bodies. The bodies exuded a fear, a sweat which was so poignant that to young nostrils, that was quite extraordinary. And some people who were deeply Orthodox, when they lined up, they kept on saying, I believe in God, the Shema Israel words. It's quite interesting that from the group of us who came here to this country, 732, quite a lot of them received a wonderful Hebrew education from the age of 2.5 and 3. And a number of them are very Orthodox now. Some say the prayer so beautifully that I called before the Bima, which is the main table, to recite on a Shabbat. And I haven't got such skills, really, because my teacher was not the one that was acceptable to my family when I showed them the bruises on my thighs, when I made mistakes and he kept on pinching. So, really, I, in a way, envy them because their learning, Hebrew learning, was so wonderful and so deep.
You've heard others say, you know, that where was God in the Holocaust? Where was God in the camps? But you have indicated that God did exist for you somewhere.
Yes, one carried that light within one, but one found that one was powerless against the brutalities. I know Elie Wiesel accuses God when he talks about children being murdered. But I think really that religion, in a way, is—I don't know whether I blaspheme when I say that—akin to art. Some people can be brutal killers and go back and listen to Beethoven and Schumann and other composers, and they can commit terrible atrocities. So I think really that the religious feeling does not ensure that you are absolutely good, that you are moral and humane and respect the life of others. It's most probably a very bad thing to say in certain ways, because it shatters the foundation of morality. One thinks that once you have a deep religious experience, then you most probably will remain a very, very good person. But quite a lot of the killers may have been people who once believed and then that succumb to this. I don't know, really, because I haven't researched into the past. But within the selection, within camps, those SS, like Mengele and others who were highly educated, knew how to choose murderers and killers and psychopaths, in order to turn the whole structure of a camp upside down so that the worst elements were the top dogs. Yes. Say on that. You know, thinking about it and contemplating on this, I feel really that and not enough stress is being laid on the sanctity of life. I know in one way now, when the world has become very populated, we have to somehow get together and find that we don't overcrowd this planet, that we're all sharing it. But from another point of view, we must have a reverence for life. And that has to be deeply ingrained, that it's passed on from generation to generation. To take somebody else's life is the ultimate of crime. And based on that, we have in Ten Commandments, I shall not kill, but it must be very much firmer. It must be put right next to the sort of everybody's spirituality, no matter whether it's religious or not. Excuse me.
How do you feel about talking about your Holocaust experience?
I don't talk very much because I didn't talk to my children until they were grown up. And I really feel that I cannot see the person-to-person purpose of talking. I know people have curiosity. We are all very curious. We all like chit-chat. We like certain gossips. And I find this is too deep simply to treat it as a gossip. You ask me these questions. I haven't thought about them before, but, excuse me, I was very apprehensive of really recording my past. Just simply because to record it, to get it all out of me, and secondly, I was wondering what kind of person is going to sit opposite me now. And we have become close sort of acquaintances or friends. And I find that with some people one has closer understanding, which again is not explicit. I cannot say why, but one senses it, and therefore it has been made easier for me to talk.
Talking to your children, you know, why did you? At what stage did you decide that you could do this or wanted to do that?
At a stage when I felt that they should know what the father went through, and at the stage when they were in a teenage form that they could take this, perhaps it would be a great shock to them, but each of the three children of mine took it differently. My eldest daughter was by far most affected by what I had to say. But she was always sensitive in a different way. So I told them in certain stages, I didn't say, sit down, I'm going to unload myself and I'm going to tell you all about the terrible suffering of the Holocaust and the time that I went through and the loss of my parents. I think really they found out, even before they were 10, little bits, because they knew that they had no grandfather. Where was he? He died. Where did he die? During the Holocaust. And things like that. But I just felt that to unload myself and to put this whole feeling of the past on them might rather distort the path of their life.
Do you think what you experienced as a young child, you know, losing all your family the way you did it make a difference to your parenting, the sort of father you were, the way you acted towards your children, do you think?
I acted the way I felt I ought to act.
Did you feel you wanted to protect them?
Yes, I had when they were very tiny, I loved looking after them. That was a wonderful thing, coming back from the office and looking after them. My wife is a very keen swimmer and competitor, and sometimes she went on competition and I would look after them. And they were a great joy. They were lively and nice. Once she went away and we all had flu, so we existed on rice pudding from tins. But they didn't complain. We all sort of sat there, drunk lots of liquid, and I was telling them stories, and they were very happy. My relationship with my children was very close. And I love them deeply.